I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with libertarian activist Jeffrey A. Tucker. Jeffrey is editorial director of the American Institute for Economic Research, as well as a managing partner of Vellum Capital, a founder of the Atlanta Bitcoin Embassy, a senior distinguished fellow of the Austrian Economics Center in Vienna, Austria, an affiliate fellow of the Acton Institute, and a former editorial director of the Foundation for Economic Education. I wanted to have Jeffrey on the podcast as he was a student of Murray Rothbard, whose name makes an appearance in the second episode of Parallax Views, which featured my interview with Elizabeth Sandifer on her book, Neo-Reaction: A Basilisk, Essays on and Around the Alt-Right. Elizabeth made a forceful argument that Murray Rothbard was a key influence, a predecessor of sorts, for what would become known as neo-reaction, a movement often related to the alt-right. Jeffrey A. Tucker would make the exact opposite argument. As a student of Rothbard and one of the, if not the, foremost libertarian critic of the alt-right, who's written a book on the subject entitled Right-Wing Collectivism, The Other Threat to Liberty, and has had a very public spat with one of the alt-right's leading figures, Richard Spencer. Although I am not a libertarian or a devotee of the ideas of Murray Rothbard, I wanted to give Jeffrey a chance to speak about Murray, his relationship with him, and his critique of the alt-right through a libertarian Rothbardian lens. I'll let you, the listener, decide for yourself if Murray Rothbard was a predecessor to neo-reaction and the alt-right, and whether or not libertarianism can have a limited alliance of sorts with other ideologies, such as the progressive left. I hope you enjoy my interview with Jeffrey A. Tucker, and I'd like to give a shout out to Jeffrey and thank him for coming on the show and having a dialogue with someone of a different political persuasion. Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Gonna transition into the interview with a track by Heroic Monk called Resistance. We'll be right back. Welcome to Parallax Views, Jeffrey Tucker.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So I wanted to have you on because I had a previous guest that sort of had issues with this thinker, Murray Rothbard, and said some things that I thought weren't necessarily, I thought they were pretty biased. So from your perspective, who was Murray Rothbard?
I'm sorry, I'm delaying the answer to that. That is a gigantic question. And this is one of the reasons that people so, I think, he left himself vulnerable always to being misinterpreted, misunderstood, because he was such a complicated figure who led such a gigantic life. I mean, it's and it's spanning the whole second half of the 20th century and all of its political, changes and he always had a response to whatever going on around him. I mean, he's just a wildly creative intellectual and a very restless intellectual. So, and an adaptive intellectual, you know. So, and he extracted information from around him, wherever it was, passionate about ideas and history, but also about making social change. And I think it was that latter point that led him to, kind of a circuitous journey, from the beginning of his career, which really began probably about when he was 20 years old, when 1946, and led him in a lot of different directions until his death in 1995. Now, I knew him well between 1985 and 1995, so I got to see the last, in some sense, the most controversial stage of his development, I guess you could say. But I'm also aware of many aspects of what took place before I knew him. I can just tell you that one of the reasons he's interesting is that his principles never really changed. I mean, even from the age of 20, he had a consistent framework that, it grew more sophisticated over time, but he was basically, a solid classical liberal, growing out of his family's heritage, meaning that his basic conviction was that society should be left alone. There should be free speech, freedom of action, freedom of association, and that should be rooted in a sense of ownership, and that the state was just nothing but trouble. Basically, that was his view. So there is a kind of consistent strain in his thought that surprisingly for an intellectual of his maturity and longevity, that actually never changed. But what did change was his judgment concerning the best way to get from here to there, which he always believed had to be mediated by the prevailing political culture. And it's that leads us to wonder, why did this guy write an article praising Che Guevara? Why was he kind of soft on Lenin? Why did he link up with Pat Buchanan? How is it that he wrote an article praising David Duke and so on? And I think it really comes down to sort of Rothbard's desire to make a difference in the time and in the political firmament in which he lived, because he didn't want to be an irrelevant person. I mean, he didn't want to just be a pure intellectual. He kind of wanted to lead a movement, or at least guide a movement towards making real changes, and that's kind of a crapshoot in a way, And that's what leads his legacy to be so sort of mixed and confusing, and led him to be vulnerable to the charge that all kinds of charges from both the left and the right. I mean, we can't forget that, Bill Buckley, after his death, reminded the world through an obituary that Murray was the only person ever associated with National Review who stood on the streets and cheered as Khrushchev drove by in a caravan in whatever year that would have been. I don't know if that was 1958 or something like that. I mean, that was Murray. And for, as far as Bill Buckley was concerned, that made him a traitor, and if not a communist. So, and then you have all these other people, these alt-right, trolls online, claiming Murray as their progenitor and so on. So yeah, that's why the confusion.
Well, I was going to say one of the great things about Murray Rothbard that I respect him for, even if my politics are a little bit different, is that libertarians like Murray Rothbard have probably been more consistent in a lot of ways than the left on questions of anti-imperialism and anti-intervention.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because this was really very central to Rothbard's formation. You have to remember, so he's 20 years old in 1946, right? So just as World War II is ending and the U.S. had gone through this tremendous trauma of war, and before that kind of corporate statism, even fascism of the New Deal, which, by the way, the left weirdly acquiesced to as early as 1932. So he's 20 years old, and he's like, okay, so here we are at a new time in American history. We're going to get through this trauma of World War II. We have a fresh start. What is it we believe? And Murray very much allied himself with free market economics. He was an undergraduate in economics at Columbia University at the time. But his allegiances were very clear. And by the way, in 1946, Murray could use the term liberal and presume that people more or less knew what he meant. This is a different time and a different place. Like, I'm a liberal. Okay, well, what does that mean? Well, it means you don't think government should manage any aspect of social, cultural, intellectual, or economic life in a nation. I mean, that's what Murray's conviction was. But so between 1946 and 1949, we had this weird thing happen. A kind of triangulation occurred. Our former allies in World War II, they were the Russians and Stalin in particular, and now you had a toggling taking place between 46 and 48 for political power in Washington. So you had Truman basically pivot on the Russian question as a way of outmaneuvering the Republicans in Congress, and he became an anti-communist, right? So we're talking about like 1948, and the part of the goal here was to pass a huge package of Reconstruction aid in Europe. It turns out most of which came to benefit American corporations, but it was sold under the rubric of anti-communism. Oh, look what the communists are doing in Greece. Oh my God, they won an election. We've got the Iron Curtain's falling over Europe. We've got a new problem. It's no longer the Nazis. It's no longer the imperialist Japanese. Now it's the Red Army is all over Europe, and the Reds are the great threat. So Murray saw this all taking place, and it really made him think about the relationship between limited government at home and the imperialist ambition abroad. So by the early 1950s, and by the way, he was friends with the two most important and intellectual influences in New York, besides Ludwig von Mises, who basically had an influence on his economic theory, were Frank Chodorov, a son of a Russian Jewish immigrant from the late 19th century, who became a hardcore anarchist in New York intellectual circles. And then Ayn Rand, who had just been rising through the ranks and becoming a kind of a popular novelist. And so those were his two most important influences on politics, Chodorov and Rand, during the 1950s. And Murray had to kind of take sides, because the right wing in those days went all in for the anti-communist cause. Do you understand what I mean by that and why? I mean, it was a strange time, because The right wing in the 1930s was against entry into World War II.
The old right. They were very. Murray actually is part of an anti-interventionist tradition within the right.
That's
you
right.
Know, there's that line of old right and new left unite against the Vietnam War. I think that's where Murray was coming from.
Yeah, and that happened like 10 years later. So what he saw the Republicans and the so-called conservatives, which is not even a word that was used in the 1940s. It wasn't really used until the early 1950s. The new conservative movement, you know, founded by Bill Buckley and National Review and kind of Russell Kirk with, you know, with which had a different cast to it. It was kind of codified old-fashionedism in a way, you know, combined with an imperialist foreign policy. Murray just rejected that completely. He's like, well, okay, maybe 10 years ago I could have been considered a right-winger because all you people were against the war and you were against the New Deal. Now I don't know really entirely what I am. He really dissented from the right wing on questions of war and peace and kind of made that his signature contribution. And we have to remember he paid a huge professional price for this. I mean, Murray never stopped paying professional prices for every position he took. I mean, he could have been a great economist, graduate from Columbia. He rejected Keynesianism, marginalized himself that way. And then he had this kind of ready-made movement that he could have been a part of, you know, which was constructed by Bill Buckley and the emergent right wing of the post-war period. And then he turned out to be the one guy, he and Chodorov together, with a couple of, you know, writers in the dotage, you know, like John T. Flynn or Garrett, something like this, and dissented from the right wing. And that was a really signature position for him. So, yeah, when Vietnam War came along, he was completely with the left. And for a good part of – I mean, he didn't want to go with the left, by the way. He was kind of considered himself a dissident right winger throughout the late 1950s. And by the early 1960s, he was more and more looking at, like, these people are hopeless. You know, the right wing and their love of nationalism, you're always tainted by a kind of a little bit of a racialism, you know, combined with, you know, an imperialist ethos and foreign policy, you know, which inevitably bleeds to sort of love of censorship, maybe even affection for theocracy and monarchy, revanchist, phalangist, you know, rightist ideologies. Like, okay, that I cannot abide. And he really just put a stake in the ground and said, that's it. So 10 years later, and we're talking about, let's move forward to the early 1970s, Murray saw all this come to fruition with the election of Richard Nixon, who was kind of a pre-Trumpian figure, you know, Richard Nixon. I mean, his whole thing was like, down with drugs, you know, yay, drug war, down with communism, let's go after communism. Censorship's great. You know, there's always a hint of racial antagonism and resentment and law and order, you know. So Murray, you know, the rise of Nixonism on the right was it. And that was the period we're talking about, like Nixon won in 1968. Murray had it by 1972. The Libertarian Party was founded in opposition to the prevailing trends within the Republican Party and National Review style conservatism, and Murray was the leading guru. Murray opposed the party at first, finally came on board, wrote his book called For a New Liberty, which I think came out in 1973, and lots of op-eds for the New York Times. He founded kind of a movement called libertarianism, but let's remember the context of the time. It was an anti-rightist, pro-freedom movement. That was kind of the capstone of everything that had happened to Murray over the previous 25 or 30 years, you know, was to found this dissident movement that the right wing was hopelessly corrupt. We needed something completely new. And in some ways, I feel like it was a kind of his most intellectually prescient moment, you know, the moment where he realizes, okay, the left is not a reliable ally. The right is completely corrupt. We need something completely new, something really consistently dedicated to human liberty across the board, you know, civilly, socially, religiously, and economically. We need to recapture the original liberalism of the Enlightenment and lead it to its finalized state in a and what he called anarcho-capitalism, which is kind of a funny neologism that I think he might have invented. But basically, he wanted to abolish the state. And that's where he kind of made his mark. And that was it. That was the early 1970s. And you really have to go way forward in time, all the way till 1989, to see even a slightest hint of what today, you know, people regard as his rightist thought coming back. And I don't even think that's very authentic, you know. I'm not saying it did come back. And we can talk about that and, you know, the explanation for what happened after 1989. But that's his... So the reason I'm explaining all this is that... I mean, Murray Rothbard was many things. He was an economist. He was a historian. You know, he was a kind of a cultural critic. But from a political point of view, from 1946 all the way to 1989, he was a consistent anti-imperialist and a dissident against the right, like primarily, you know, and then against the left secondarily, because he was always disappointed that they were unreliable allies in the cause of freedom.
Well, I wanted to comment on this, his alliances with the new left during Vietnam, because... One of the things I find interesting about Murray Rothbard is that, unlike a lot of people when it comes to politics, he understood the practicality and importance of limited tactical alliances. As I've said to a lot of people before, it's important to work with libertarians even if you're a leftist, at least on issues of being anti-war and civil liberties. You know, when Trump came to office, I told leftists that libertarians can actually be our best allies in a lot of ways, at least on those issues. And I think Murray understood that.
Are you regretting saying that now? Because I mean, I have to say, I mean, we all live in our own sort of social containers these days, so it's hard to tell what anybody thinks or knows anymore.
But I bet some people be open to it.
Well, I think you're basically right. But I mean, speaking as a libertarian, I have been devastated. At the libertarian silence in the face of Trump. I mean, I've been absolutely horrified, you know, like on a whole series of issues, you know, from trade, most obviously, for God's sake. But immigration, you know, what's taking place every day in this country with regard to immigration is a complete violation of all civil liberties, civil human rights, a freedom of association, even commercial freedom, you know? I mean, and libertarians, at least from what I can see, have been not very good on these subjects. Like, so that's just my impression. I'm not sure what yours is. But.
What I've seen a few libertarians go in this sort of alt-right direction. People like Christopher Cantwell. It's been pretty... sad to me, because I remember libertarians, like I said, during the Bush era, libertarians were actually very good allies.
Yeah, I you know, I could talk to you all day about this, but it's been devastating to me personally to see what happened to libertarians. And so I think if I were going to shorten it, a lot of libertarians just kind of onboarded too quickly. Without a lot of intellectual depth, and they got very easily manipulated by nationalist, racialist rhetoric from the right, and they were intellectually unprepared to deal with it. And you know, let's not forget that identitarianism is kind of the basest form of politics there is, and it's very easy for a person to go, well, I'm not sure what's true anymore, but this much I know, I'm a white dude. You know?
Well, you know, I do want to get back to Murray Rothbard, but since we're on this thread, I wanted you to talk about, for my listeners, your encounter And you're having to deal with Richard Spencer.
Okay. Well, actually, if you don't mind, let me just back up really quickly with, do you mind if I back up really quickly with Murray? Because I.
Yes. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. But only because I've truly never spoken about these issues with anybody, and I'm kind of excited you're asking me about it, just because, first of all, there's very rare to find an interviewer intelligent enough to raise these topics with, you understand? So I don't want to let this opportunity go by. After 1989, we have to remember the state of the world. I mean, like, for 40 years, the right wing in America was consumed with anti-communist frenzy. I mean, and that was the number one thing. It dwarfed every other issue. And Murray used to tell stories about going to large conventions and standing up and denouncing rent control in New York City, denouncing censorship, you know, by Federal Communications Commission, denouncing, you know, antitrust regulation, denouncing, fascism from the Commerce Department, whatever, or denouncing the Fed. And people would, like, politely clap, and the next speaker would stand up and say, the atheist Ruskies are going to come at you. We should bomb them with nuclear weapons. And then everybody would stand up on their chairs and cheer, right? So Murray was so glad for that era to be over after the end of the Cold War. And he thought, oh, my God, these people can actually be allies with us again if we can just get rid of their insane anti-communism and anti-Russianism. In particular, that had consumed them for so long. So Murray convinced himself that this was true. I mean, gradually he came to the conclusion that this is what corrupted the right during his whole life. Now that factor is gone, so maybe there's a chance for redemption. So Murray made his best pitch that he could. So over the coming 5 years that he was alive, he died in 1995, he wrote a series of articles that were designed to both convince the right wing of libertarianism, but in the first instance convince the right wing in America that he was an ally, that they could trust him, that they should read his works, that he believed in freedom same as they did, that they should believe in freedom even more. So he tried to become a real friend to these people. Do you understand? So I think that, look, I'm just going to say that I think, I'm just going to be presumptuous here and say, okay, there are, Murray probably made some mistakes in this period, right? Sometimes what happens to us, if we're trying to ingratiate ourselves with a certain movement, with the goal of changing that movement, there's a danger of that the people who currently follow you will be misled into actually following you into the errors you're trying to fix. You see what I mean? So what I'm afraid what happened was that Murray ended up convincing a lot of libertarians of conservatism and not that many conservatives of libertarianism. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. I follow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an awkward situation for Murray because, like, people pull out these like, for, let me just give one example, the immigration question. Okay, so Murray had written for basically 40 years for free immigration, and he had about two sentences in one article published in, like, 1992 or 1993 saying, well, it's true that immigration can be used by the central state to disorient people with their demographic attachments in a way that makes them more easy to manipulate by an external foreign power. Okay, so he has this sort of passing thing, and he says under those conditions, you know, free migration is not conducive to the promotion of liberty. So everybody pulls that sentence out without paying attention to the fact that he was a passionate advocate of open immigration for the previous 40 years. You know, like, look, I agree he should have never written that, or at least he should have explained it in more detail. But also people are fallible. You know, I mean, we can't look to intellectuals to be the perfect embodiment of all purity and holy consistently for their entire lives. I mean, I feel like we need to give the guy a break. You know, there's one other point before we move on to Richard Spencer here. And I just want to make this point. Murray believed very strongly in disrupting the political system. He, like, more than anything else, he was an anarchist, but he did not want a powerly deep state establishment that, in a Machiavellian sense, believed themselves to be unchallengeable and unchallenged. So he tended always to favor the most disruptive candidate, whoever it was. So he was a fan of George McGovern. He opposed anybody who was against whoever's in power.
Well, so, he did the eulogy for Che Guevara, as you mentioned, exactly. Which threw a lot of people off,
Right. And so he loved Che Guevara because Che Guevara overthrew the Batista regime, which he considered to be fascistic and evil. So, and this is why he liked Lenin, because Lenin was this revolutionary figure who overthrew the czarist, the imperialist, fascistic czarist establishment. So that's the one strain. It's like he's always championing the outsider and against whoever's got the power now. So Murray in the early 1990s saw the rise of a kind of what he considered to be sort of a social democratic egalitarian. This is a word he really liked. Egalitarian hegemon, fastening itself over American political culture, and saw the right wing in those days. And we're talking about the early 1990s. I mean, it's hard to remember, but this is, there's 1994, for example, there was a big, rightist, anti-government movement that was rising up. Murray became a champion of that because he saw it as not the establishment and the biggest way to disrupt the status quo. Okay, then he dies, 1995. So the thing that happens to people when they die is that they can no longer interact with history. They can no longer change their minds. They can no longer change their strategic outlook. They can no longer learn from the unfolding of history, and so on and so on. It's like terrible. So now you fast forward 20 years, and everybody's grabbing onto these temporary thoughts that Murray had in the early 1990s and saying, oh, look, they apply now. But, I mean, we don't know what Murray would think today. We don't. I mean, the rise of the Trump fascist, the fascistic nationalist, racialist, nativist, revanchist, Trumpy, pro-dictatorship, pro-despot, pro-censorship movement in this country, I think would have absolutely disgusted and mortified Murray and would have led him, and I'm speculating here, right? We don't know. Led him to recall his early writings from the late, from the mid and late 60s, in which he denounced all these various movements by name with great passion, great energy. And I think he would be doing the same today. So, okay, let's just move forward to Richard Spencer. Well,
I want to ask one more thing, if I can. Because I've heard you tell this story of in the 90s, I guess you and Murray were working on forming alliances with the populist right. And Murray had a warning, I guess, for you about that.
Yeah. Let me just repeat what happened again. Because, by the way, when I first told that story, I actually was trolled really hard. And people say anything online, right? So people were claiming that I was just completely lying about that, which, it's just weird. Like, why would I make up something like that? So what happened was in 1989, there was a dissident group of not neoconservatives who were, at the time, the neoconservatives, they were saying things like, okay, so what? The Cold War is over. Now we got to find a new enemy. Maybe it's China. Maybe it's Islam. Maybe it's somebody else. Something to keep the Cold War military state in place. And there were dissidents at the time called the paleoconservatives. I don't know if we even use that word anymore, but the paleoconservatives were anti-imperialist. And Murray thought, okay, these guys can embrace libertarians and be our allies. So we went up to a meeting, and it was just – it was very interesting looking back at it. I mean, it was the most implausible assembly of figures. So I was there, and – Mel Bradford is kind of a Southern historian, celebrator of federalism, and to some extent a champion of the Confederacy, although he's from Texas, and it's hard to say to what extent the Confederacy meant anything in Texas history. And there was Thomas Fleming, who was a kind of, I would call him a kind of politics of human nature, sort of sort of classical statist reactionary. Paul Godfrey, the leading interpreter of Carl Schmitt, you know, the friends that, you know, the politics of friends of any, basically, you know, an assembly of very interesting, you know, oddballs, you know, which would later become kind of quasi alt-right figures. And then there was me, and Murray was of course a libertarian, and there was an attempt to kind of put together a coalition. So after the first, and by the way, they opposed the welfare warfare state. I was pretty damn young at the time, right? But I really, really wanted this to work, mainly because I wanted Murray to have colleagues, and I wanted to have colleagues. And at that time, Murray was kind of on the outs with the libertarians, because the libertarians had all kind of moved to Washington and become very conventional, you know, sort of policy advisors. You know, here's the kind of policies we should have. I mean, very establishment-oriented. Murray didn't like that either. So I was hoping something could come of this. Also, I had friends at the time that were decompressing from the Cold War ideology, like friends like Tom Bethel. Joe Sobrin was a very dear friend. He was supposed to be the successor to Bill Buckley until his life kind of fell apart and so on. Oh, but Joe Sobrin was there also. Anyway, so I was kind of hopeful about these meetings. So, and again, I'm a little bit naive. I hadn't done a lot of reading about the history of right Hegelianism. I didn't understand the statist history of rightist ideology in general. So I was still in a learning phase. So we got through the first hour of meeting these guys. And they're like, yeah, down with the welfare state, it sucks. Down with the warfare state, it sucks, you know. And I was like, oh, that's right. Wow, we agree with these people. This is really going to be interesting. So after the first hour, I was just sitting with Murray, and we had a coffee break. And I sat down with him on a wooden bench in the hallway. I said, hey, Murray, this is really exciting. I think there's really something going on here. But there might be a certain magic, you know, certain coming together. You know, it's kind of exciting, right, Murray? And Murray said to me, he goes, Jeffrey, this is never going to work. We can never, ever be in a coalition with these people. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you can't. He said, look, we got a whole room full of people there. None of these people believe in universal human rights. Like, they just reject human rights. And they reject all universals. So under those conditions, you might not see their errors now, but I promise you they're there, and we cannot be allies with them for this reason.
Wow. The really great thing about that story, and like I said, it's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. People have tried to say that Murray Rothbard was, you know, like crypto white nationalist or a crypto fascist. And I don't think that's true.
It's utter rot. I mean, it's complete rot. I mean,
Murray was Jewish.
Well, that's true. And it's not, well, that's true. And it's not even just his identity. Yes. New York Russian Jew, but not even his identity. I mean, his ideology, everything about his ideology stood opposed to that. Now, I mean, he was also a little bit of a mischievous person. So, you know, was he tolerant of more in those days than maybe he should have been? But I'm just telling you, his first instincts that day were extremely stern, way more stern than I wanted them to be. So you have to understand, from my perspective, I did not want to hear this because I wanted these people to be our friends. Right? Look, who cares what I think? I was just a stupid kid. But I had some hope for this movement. And so Murray just shot it down on this, seems like very strict, very stern, almost dogmatic terms. You don't believe in the primacy of universal human rights, you can never really be a reliable friend of liberty, period. That's what Murray told me.
And he didn't care what your color was, your race, your screed. It was a universal thing.
That, for him, that was it. And I was shocked. I mean, my attitude was like, that's going a little too far, right, Murray? Come on. You know, you're opposed to welfare state, you're opposed to welfare, you know, warfare state. Okay, you might be not so great on immigration, free trade, but I mean, why can't we be friends? Murray was like, all right, we can be friends, but we can never be allies in any kind of political struggle. Now, it's true that over the coming years, you know, over the whatever years were left, 3 or 4 years, he apparently softened in that view, you know, like he was willing to kind of give it a go. And maybe he shouldn't have been. Actually, I think Murray was just kind of delighted by the action and the activity. And so I'm just telling you that his first instincts, and I have no reason to think he ever gave up those instincts, by the way, were to say, here is my bridge of acids. You know, here's my Pons acid norm. Here's my acid test. Universal human rights is the basis on which all political coalitions have to cohere and come to exist. We can argue about what those rights are, how they come to be, how they're enforced, how they're instantiated in the political world. Those are all very interesting arguments. But at least we have to begin with the acknowledgement that the first principle of political philosophy is universal human rights. That was Murray Rothbard.
Well, I think that's a great summation there. I wanted you to touch briefly on it. I know people I've talked to that the new Murray Rothbard said that they noted his knack for being very warm and humorous and optimistic. And even I've always been a big fan of the short play he did about Ayn Rand. Mozart was a Red, because it's such a humorous little play.
It's fun. And you know, the funny thing is that the people who love that more than anything else are the Randians themselves. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I played Nathaniel Brandon in the YouTube version of that, at Murray's, 60th birthday party, which you can watch on. I mean, nobody believes it's me because I think I was like 22 years old or something, you know. But it's pretty funny. I was Nathaniel Brandon in that play.
So do you have any anecdotes you'd like to share about that sort of warmth and humor and optimism
you had? And yeah, you know, so Murray could be a stern figure, but he had to work at it, actually. That wasn't his default, you know. His default was wild humor, funny, reckless, intellectual abandon. Really wanted to free your mind of all prevailing orthodoxies. And the funny thing about Murray is, you know, he was just like an information extraction machine. He would get, it's like he was like an addict for ideas, you know. And whenever he would meet anybody, he would like pump them for whatever it was that they were interested in, and get every bit of interesting information they had about it, their views, their citations, people they've met, ideas they had about this or that. He just extracted information from everybody. And he did this to me all the time. And this is, you know, you wonder, why did Murray inspire so many people? Partially he inspired people because people were strongly incentivized to research and read and understand things so that they could report back to Murray what they learned, so that he would be delighted and laugh and praise them. You know, it's a funny way that he became a mentor to so many people. I remember sitting at dinner with him one day, and I've always been interested in the history of religion, although Murray eventually became much more of an expert on the subject than I ever was, even though I was really steeped in it. And Murray demanded, he wanted to know what, you know, why is it that Eastern Christianity took such a different form than Western Christianity? Western Christianity became all about progress and human rights and change and adaptation to the modern world, eventually, not, you know, the first millennium, but, you know, after the Great Schism, of the 11th century, Western Christianity gradually became very much overlapping with Enlightenment sensibilities in terms of universal rights and, you know, up with progress and, yay, let's build a beautiful world around us and so on. Whereas Eastern Christianity always kind of maintained more of a hierarchical affections and never really became universalist, and Murray was convinced that this affected the history of the countries that Eastern Christianity prevailed in versus Western Christianity, and he wanted to know whether or not and to what extent this had anything to do with the great dispute over the filioque clause in the Apostles' Creed. It was in the Nicene Creed, not the Apostles' Creed. The Nicene Creed, filioque means that the Spirit proceeds not just from the Father but from the Son also. And so we're at dinner, and he wants to know, Jeffrey, did the filioque clause, embraced by the West and rejected by the East, did that have anything to do with the way these iterations of Christianity took shape over time? So he asked me this question, and I gave my best attempt at an answer that if you believe in the fullness of the incarnation, that God really becomes man, and that from that man exudes the third person of the Trinity, then that offers a kind of a blessing to the material world, so that the body becomes good, materialism becomes good, prosperity and progress becomes good. And maybe that's ultimately what the filioque clause embodies. So I gave my answer, and he was completely riveted by this. He was like, that is fascinating, and began to pump me for more information about this. But I very quickly ran out of information. Like, I felt like I had said everything I could possibly say about it. And Murray kept pushing and pushing and pushing. When I ran out of detail or data or arguments, I remember that night at dinner that he was disappointed. Like, he really thought I was going to get some really in-depth references and resources and ideas from me, but I ran out very quickly. And so he was kind of like grumbled a little bit and moved on to the next topic. But that's the way Murray was. He always wanted to know things, like whatever it was, whoever it was, he wanted to know what they knew. So that was Murray.
Well, I know we want to move on to Richard Spencer, but I just remembered there was one more thing I had to ask because I wanted to give you time to rebut what was said by my previous guest. I had another guest on who talked about the alt-right and talked about how some alt-right people were trying to claim Rothbard.
Yeah.
And her take was that Rothbard's anti-egalitarianism would have led to people who were not physically or mentally capable of rising up in a capitalist society, that they would just be sort of left for dead. How would you respond to that? I want to give you time to rebut that.
So what I would point to is the first chapter of his book, For New Liberty, which imagines... It's a very broad-minded book, right? So he imagines a beautiful world of universal prosperity where no one is left behind, everyone has opportunity, where the tribal associations of the past, the classes and the castes that defined the old world melted away, and everyone embraced each other in a kind of a universal cooperation in building society together. And that's the Murray I know. In all my years of knowing him, I never once heard him put anybody down for their class or race or caste or background or anything else.
Any type of handicaps. Like I said, I don't think Murray,
no.
I never got the impression that Murray Rothbard would be like, oh, that person is mentally handicapped or that person is physically handicapped, get rid of him. I don't think he thought that.
I never heard the slightest word from him like that. I mean, I've heard that from people from fascistic strains, on the right. I mean, you're going to hear that kind of stuff all the time, but Murray never said anything remotely like that to me. I mean, that's just not, and his vision, like, Murray believed in universal emancipation.
A voluntary society.
Yeah. And not just, okay, you can do what you want, but if we can build institutions that enable everybody to make choices, then we'll come together and build a beautiful commonwealth. We'll build a beautiful global society of cooperation and universal human ennoblement. I mean, that was the dream that motivated Murray throughout his entire life.
Cooperation without coercion.
Exactly. Right. That's sort of the magic of human relationships extended over the entire planet, without any restriction on people, without any artificial restrictions. Of course, Murray believed too that there was, you know, there is an iron law of oligarchy, that there is no such thing as equality except equality of freedom. You know, that was the kind of equality he believed in. But he also very much worried about what he called egalitarianism, you know, the longing to force people to have, I guess what you would call equality of condition. He thought was a very dangerous motivation, led ultimately to statism, coercion, and violation of freedom of association, property rights. So to that extent, he was like really against a kind of a Rousseauian leftism, and he wrote about that constantly. But in so doing, he never gave up his fundamental vision, really utopian vision, in the best possible way, which, again, I always like point people to the first chapter of For New Liberty, which is really his great manifesto, where he really does imagine a society of classless society of universal prosperity.
Well, I think that's a good way to top off the portion of our discussion dealing with Murray Rothbard. And I think this is a good point where we can get into this issue of the alt-right and your encounter with Richard Spencer, and maybe even what Murray would have thought of these people like Richard Spencer.
Yeah, right. So Murray actually, you know, he wrote a book called Betrayal of the American Right. The first draft came out in something like 1968, where he condemned, again, you know, the racism, the phalangist, the revanchist, reactionary attitudes of the right wing. And you know, what I in my latest book called Right Wing Hegelianism, I mean, Murray saw the right as being inherently statist, you know, because they would use the state to, because they loved hierarchy more than anything else, they would use the state to enforce those hierarchies. I think Murray would have, at least the Murray of 1960, of the late 1960s, early 1970s, would have been seen Richard Spencer and his ilk exactly for what they are, is just thoroughgoing statists and you know, very dangerous figures in public life. So,
well, they're statists for their group only. They want their group to win. Yeah.
Yeah. They want power. Like, they're against the existing state, in favor of a state of their own construction. You know. Which is a tendency you see on both the left and the right. I mean, you saw this with the late Marxists, but also, I mean, the alt-right is definitely against, you know, the state as we know it, but because it's insufficiently coercive and doesn't have enough power to exclude people. I mean, the anti-liberalism takes two forms, right? Leftism and rightism are both anti-liberalism in a Rothbardian sense. So I think Rothbard would have been thoroughly disgusted with Richard Spencer. And I just know these people because, you know, I worked for the Mises Institute for many years, and I saw the rise of this alt-right and the right wing, and they became ever more menacing and with predictable tropes. You know, it's race theory and demographic analysis. Demography is destiny, just like the old eugenicists used to say. And then that always leads inevitably to the Jewish problem, and what are we going to do about the Jews, and their control of the banks and the media, and the Holocaust never happened. I mean, you know, the level of, you know, crankism and craziness just unfolds like, I don't know what, just inevitable. It's like dominoes falling. And I had encountered these people for years. So it's been very weird for me after the rise of the Trump movement. All these people, you know, came to believe that the reason for the rise of Trump was essentially this white nationalist view, which, you know, which never went away. You know, it built throughout the 20th century, and of course, yes, it became embodied in the Hitler movement. And I'm sorry for mentioning Hitler, but I'm sorry. I mean, you have to talk about Hitler because Hitlerian ideology took over all of Europe, Northern Africa, and Southern Russia, and almost took over the entire civilized world not too many years ago. So Hitler really does matter, and the ideological forces behind Hitler really does matter. And so these people sort of dabbled in all the exact same ideological tendencies that led to the fascination of totalitarian ideology over the once free world. So I think it's really relevant. So when this stuff came along, I recognized it for what it was, and I saw that they were trolling the libertarian movement really hard, because for a number of reasons, libertarians are dissidents, but also libertarians are very naive. We like believe in free speech and free discussion, and we're in a funny way, we had way too much tolerance towards these people and too much naivety. Like, we didn't recognize the fullness of the evil they represented even when they came to our conferences and, you know, try to disrupt talks with racialist, anti-Semitic blather, and so on.
Well, Richard Spencer tried to crash a libertarian conference, I believe, right? And you stood up to that.
Right. So what happened was, I went to the Students for Liberty conference, and we were having a really good meeting. It was good. There were several thousand people there. And somebody came up to me and said, Richard Spencer's in the lobby. And I thought, oh, here we go again, right? I mean, these people, this is what they do. They're trolls. They're professional trolls. And I knew exactly what he was doing. He showed up, and I knew he had called the media ahead of time. And he was holding court in the lobby, in the bar outside of the conference. And a sign that he held up said, this is the Students for Liberty session on race and, you know, and demographics, something like that. And he gathered around him a bunch of, you know, silly undergraduates that are listening to him like some sort of prophet. And I knew what was going on here. It would, you know, I was thinking about the newspapers the next day. Was it going to be Richard Spencer, you know, quasi-Nazi fascist, holds court at the Students for Liberty conference, and that would have been a disaster for us. And it just made me angry. It's like, why can't these people just hold their own conferences? You know, why do they always have to troll us so hard, you know? And somebody's got to stand up to these people. This is our event. He doesn't belong here. He didn't get a ticket. He's only there, ironically, because of public accommodation laws. I'm sure that the Marriott or wherever the hotel was, if they had gotten the message that a Nazi was coming in to give a speech in the bar, would have thrown him out on his ear. You know, but thanks to public accommodation laws, they can't really do that. So somebody came up to him and said, Spencer's here. And I don't know, I just thought, you know, in my mind, I was like, this SOB, you know, why doesn't he just mind his own business? You know, get out of here. So I walked upstairs, came across the hotel lobby, saw him holding court, and I don't know, the crowd parted. Somebody stuck a microphone in my face and said, what do you think about Richard Spencer attending the SFL? And not many people see it very often, but I do have a little bit of a temper. And I said, here's what I think. I think fascists don't belong at an anti-fascist conference. And just told him to get out and said, we reject all of his ideology. We reject his racism. We reject his nativism, his fascistic thinking, his anti-Semitism. We libertarians believe in universal human rights, human dignity, the ennoblement of every human person on the planet without any discrimination, restriction. Emancipation is our theme. You reject that, you need to get out of here. So that's what I told him. I have no regrets.
Well, I appreciate that you did that. And I think it's worth noting that recently Richard Spencer was asked if the alt-right really believes in free speech. And he actually said, no, of course not. That's just rhetoric. So.
Yeah, he's like the right-wing version of Herbert Marcuse. I'm sure that name means something to you.
The Frankfurt School, yes.
Yeah. Because the two versions of Hegelianism, it's not a surprise at all to see them, you know, kind of coming together against free speech. I mean, liberalism is such a great cause because, you know, we against all the trends of history, against all the establishments of the world, we, you know, for 300 or 400 years, we've gradually become more and more convinced of the virtues of religious freedom. Free speech, freedom of association, freedom of commerce and exchange, ownership. These are great ideas, but, you know, they've been opposed from the left and the right for forever. And it's not a surprise to me at all to see these kind of movements coming up around us. And I just wish libertarians would get their act together and realize what it is we believe and who we are so we could stand up to these forces more consistently and with a greater degree of confidence than we do. So I have no regrets for standing up to Spencer. I never once listened to a word he said after that. Apparently he held like 3 hours of YouTube seminars to denounce me and so on. And I was trolled extremely hard by, you know, everyone from, you know, alt-right Pepe meme makers to hardcore anti-Semitic, you know, like real neo-Nazis. I mean, the following 12 months after I threw Spencer out of the conference, I faced really predictable daily death threats. It was just what I dealt with. I wake up in the morning, they were all over my social feed, they were on my phone. It was a whole year of being violently trolled. Some silly, some innocent, some stupid, you know, early basement dwelling, you know, 20-year-olds, but there were some real Nazis came after me pretty hard, and it was pretty scary, actually. I must admit, it was actually terrifying. After Charlottesville, you know, these people are so silly. They they actually believe that they're going to inherit the stream of history. You know, they're Hegelians, you know, so they believe it's inevitable that all white people are going to go along with them. And then, so they tried really hard to create something like a mass movement at Charlottesville rallies, and it backfired really hard. And I'm glad to see that the alt-right is pretty much, as an organized movement, largely gone now, or just diminished in stature to such an extent. But, you know, ideas never go away. And, you know, there's a reason why this ideology took over Western Europe in the middle part of the 20th century. And there's a reason why, you know, that happened in Charlottesville. There's a reason why there's so much terrorism from the right all over the world, and the rise of nationalism in Europe. And I, like, libertarians need to get their act together and start standing up to these people. It's extremely important.
So what is the threat the alt-right poses then? To not just the left, but also libertarians.
Yeah. So the threat is a libertarian. So you have to understand libertarianism in our times, for the most part, you know, since the early 1970s, libertarians have come about in opposition to the left socialism and to the Marxist thought, the Marxist ways of thinking. So we're really well schooled on the problem of socialist left socialism, and our professors were all left socialists. We rejected it. We've read all the literature. We reject it. And so we're well guarded against that kind of deviation, I guess you could say. But rightist thought has never really been a problem in our generation. So we became very naive about it, really, and unprotected and unguarded from the kind of arguments that these people make. And I've seen, you know, basically the danger is massive intellectual corruption resulting from intellectual naivety and a lack of education, essentially. So, you know, some very prominent libertarian YouTubers, you know, were confronted with things like, IQ studies. And next thing you know, liberty's out the window, you know. They hear about, you know, nationalism as a force, they get intrigued by it and they throw out their libertarianism because they weren't really well schooled in it. And partially this is a failing of libertarianism. We lack intellectual sophistication on these kinds of topics. It's very sad because in the late 19th century, the liberals of the late 19th century were starting to put together a theory of nationalism, like what it is, where it's dangerous, where it's not dangerous, what it looks like, what does a liberal theory of nationalism look like. But that intellectual development of that way of thinking got interrupted by World War I, and we never really returned to it. So in the 21st century, modern libertarians are extremely vulnerable, with confronted from arguments from the right that they don't feel like they can answer. That's the problem.
And you've actually done a very good job pointing out that none of this is new. And regardless of any political differences we may have, your article, The Prehistory of the Alt-Right, is really it's a must read, because you talk about the influence of people like Thomas Carlyle, some of the ideas of Darwin in The Descent of Man, Oswald Spengler, Carl Schmitt, and Madison Grant and the eugenicists.
Oh, God. Yeah, these people, they're all very funny. And I don't know if in that article I mentioned Julio Cesare, Baron von,
Julius Evola, or?
Yeah, Evola. Yeah. Yeah. So this guy is just crazy. And one of the creepiest figures on the rightist collectivist movement of the 20th century, even worse than Carl Schmitt, actually, even worse than all the other guys you mentioned, really. He's just a complete nutcase. He made the Nazis look moderate, you know. Well, now all of his books are newly in print and being read in like something like 5 different languages. And I went to an event recently, and I don't even remember where it was, and I got confronted by some 22-year-old, you know, it's like maybe a senior in college or something like that. And he came up to me, he goes, "Look, I really want to talk to you in detail about, I really want to spar with you about ideas." And I said, "Okay, what do you want to talk about?" He said, "Well, like, I'm a convinced Evolite." I said, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, man, I've been reading all about Julius Caesar, you know, von Baron Evola, or whatever his name is, and I think he's correct about a lot of things." And I said, "Well, give me a second. I just need to process that." I had to take like 10 minutes out and like come to terms with the fact that this crazy crank mega Nazi, you know, is now through long dead, a man who considered bombing and killing to be a sacrament, you know, of his religion, is now influencing a new generation. It's weird. It's scary. It's an awesome tribute to the power of ideas, but also a warning to all of us. Like, the intellectual battle never ends.
Right. And it's all based around this idea. They go against rationalism, actually. Even though people like Spencer claim they're the rationalists, they're actually the ones that are obsessed with this mythology based in what is essentially bloodshed.
Yeah, I think that's right. And okay, so Spengler, you're saying that, you know, that applies. Yeah, I would say it applies to Spengler. That love of blood really reaches its sort of how would you say, its highest point with the writings of Carl Schmitt. And actually Evola, yeah, it's just a worship of the friend-enemy paradigm, and enemy-ness is defined by the presence of bloodshed. If you're shedding blood, if you're killing, then that's you're a great preserver of civilization and life. That's what they ultimately believe.
And Schmitt ultimately believes that friend-enemy distinction is defined by the state, and the state, its role is absolute.
Sure, it's completely arbitrary. You know, who's the friends and enemies? It's up to the state, which is basically God, to lay that out for us. And our job is, as tools in the civic religion, as just pawns or apostles in this great act of faith, you know, to just comply and go along and live a big, dramatic, fulfilling life by, you know, being loyal to our friends and slaughtering our enemies. This is the essence of life. I mean, all these people find sort of bourgeois values to be tremendously boring. They don't like liberalism. They don't like bourgeois life. They don't like backyard barbecues, baseball games, shopping malls. The commercial marketplace, they consider to be basically dominated by a Jewish ethos of lack of attachment, deracination, too much choice. I'll move where I want. I'll associate with whom I want. I'll say what I want. I'll get rich. I'll live a good life. They find that disgusting, Jewish and unmeaningful, lacking all drama. And they see this is why they've targeted liberalism as the enemy. It was the most interesting thing because, like, I saw this train wreck happening around me. Like, I knew for sure guys like Richard Spencer and some of the rightist movement that was hanging around libertarian circles was going to eventually turn on the market economy, turn on free speech, turn on free association. So I knew this because, yeah, it's not the first time it's happened, right? These people have been around basically 250 years. So we have a track record here. But I don't even think they fully knew it. You know what I mean?
No, I get you on that. And it's crazy how much you've pinpointed so much, especially the stuff with Carlyle and this his idea
great
of
man.
we have to worship sort of the hero figure and submit to that no matter what.
Well, it's interesting about Carlyle because, you know, he was a great champion of great men, whether it's Napoleon or, you know, whatever. He wanted dictators, but he also wanted the other side too. Like, it wasn't just that he wanted great rulers. He wanted entrenched people on the bottom too. So he was a strong proponent of slavery. Like, to him, a civil order without slaves, you know, was confusing and dangerous. And he despised the liberal movement of the early 19th century for such a strong push against liberalism. I mean, he's the guy who coined the term about economics, that it was a dismal science. And the reason he said it was dismal is that all the economists he knew thought we could get rid of slavery and be better off. He's like, that's disgusting. Slavery is wonderful. We have to have slavery. You people are dismal. So that's where that phrase came from.
There's like a, like I said, there's an irrational mysticism to all of this, especially someone like Spengler. You know, and Evola, all of these people.
Yeah, there's a really interesting book called The Secret History of the 20th Century that goes through a series of forms of religious fundamentalism. Anyway, we don't have to go there, but there's an occultism that's very much like what you might consider extremist Calvinism of the Gary North variety, or the ISIS Islamic totalitarianism that we've seen rise and fall in our times, extremist traditional reaction, you know, phalangist Catholicism, monarchism, all and Nazism and occultism. These people are all basically the same. They despise modernity. They hate democracy. They hate liberalism. They don't like human choice. They regret the way the market and modernity has broken down our tribal connections. And they want to reconstruct them according to what they call the politics of human nature. It's or religious teaching or whatever. I mean, they're all kind of like iterations of the same rightist, collectivist, neo-Hegelian doctrine. And once you see it, and like I say, I spent, I don't know, 2 or 3 years reading about this ideological structure, and now I feel like I just recognize it all around me. And it's weird because I see, you know, I've had some of my best friends actually go this direction, and I warn them, and they don't see it because, you know, they're unprotected from it. They're not well schooled in it, and they haven't really read about the history of it.
Well, even paleocons like I know Paul Gottfried has now spoken out against the alt right, at least so much as in saying that he disagrees with Spencer and the things Richard Spencer has been doing.
Yeah, but you know the thing is, you have to really distinguish between the inevitable factionalism of these people. I mean, you have to remember these people love to fight with each other, right? So that's just, this is how they. They don't know how to do anything but fight with each other, you know. So Paul Gottfried may not like Spencer, but Paul Gottfried is a leading interpreter and proponent of Schmittian political philosophy. Mm-hmm. In other words, he's a hardcore anti-liberal. That's just true. And I know Paul, He's a sweetheart, you know, whatever. But he's the real deal. You know, I would call him a neo-fascist, and I think in saying that, he wouldn't disagree, actually.
Well, he's certainly reactionary.
Yeah, a reactionary, and of a funny sort. Like these Schmittian neo-Hegelians, they worship, in a Carlylean way, they worship the leadership principle. They just do. Like Paul Gottfried, once I was at a free market event, and he stood up and said, look, I reject New Deal economics, and I don't know anything about economics. I defer to all you people in this room on economics. But FDR was a great and mighty leader who unified the country and gave Americans somebody to look up to and admire and follow. And to that extent, I think he's a great hero. And everybody in the room was shocked.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's shocking, too, about Gottfried is Gottfried was trained by Herbert Marcuse. And it's funny, Richard Spencer actually wrote a dissertation at one point on Adorno.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's really interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, it's amazing the way these philosophies just sort of crawl into your head. And Hegelianism, more than anything else, is like a mental disease, really. And like I say, it persists on the left and the right. And I mean, our listeners might be saying, well, what is that? And I would just simply identify it as, you know, the belief that there's a meta logic to the flow of history that takes place independent of human choice. I would say that's basically the Hegelian perspective. Like, they think they have a bead on what history is supposed to do, you know, and is going to do, regardless of what we choose as individuals. So the, like, individuals in our relationships with each other are not constructing history. History is something that's constructed for us. And we're just here to be buffeted about by these meta forces. Once you believe that, then you become a kind of a scientist of mysticism, as you say. You know, it's all very mystical, and we think we know where things are headed. And then if you want to make your life meaningful, then you contribute to making those forces take place. This, liberalism has nothing to do with this attitude. Liberalism has always been, you know, the Scottish Enlightenment sort, or even going back to the Spanish Scholastics, about the discrete ways in which you and I can improve the world on the margin. Just let's talk about what the choices we can make, the opportunities we have, the rights we have, gradually unfold an environment that's ever more safe and prosperous and ennobling for people we know and for everybody, for every human being. I mean, that's the essence of the liberal aspiration. And I think it's a good one. It's one we need to recapture.
Well, I just had one last question, and we sort of dealt with it earlier. It seemed like you were cold to the idea a little bit, but do you believe there's any way that people like myself on the more left-wing side of things and, you know, principled libertarians can at least on some issues during this Trump presidency work with each other?
Oh, tremendously. I mean, honestly, I mean, the libertarians have proven, you know, pretty unreliable on a number of questions these days. And the left has so much work to do, and libertarians should absolutely, like, you know, work with anybody who favors human rights and human liberties right now. And for God's sake, the threat to the world economy from nationalist protectionism, the rise of mercantilism, is dire at this point. And every single day I pick up the newspaper and I see what's happening, you know, on the immigration front. You know, we're losing all of our international students in our universities. Families are being torn apart at the borders. We're having our businesses invaded by thugs and bureaucrats that are enforcing all kinds of laws. We've got a despot in the White House who's making decisions to dismantle the liberal trade order that was carefully constructed over the last half century. Pretty much the only really good great political move over the last half century has been the rise of free trade, and we've got a despot in the White House that just aspires to bring it all down. Libertarians and people on the center and even the far left can absolutely work together right now, and I think the prospects of that are much stronger than anything on the right today, actually. So, I mean, what the left needs to do, and I'm not here to preach, but I mean, these distractions that the left has with identitarian politics, cultural appropriation, racial and gender identity war, the opposition to commercial freedom. I mean, all these things are very dangerous, I would say, for the left-wing ideology. And I mean, I really, really want the center-left and the real left to get back to fundamentals again, to recapture the sort of 19th century idealism. And the reason this is important is if they don't clean up their act and get rid of this identitarianism and some of these other weirder aspects of the ideology that's taken place over the last 10 or 20 years, we're going to be faced with like another decade of Trumpian reactionary ideology. I mean, Trump comes about in part as a result against the failures of the left. So how do you respond to that? Just by endless agitation against Trump? I don't think it's going to work. I mean, we need to have a really good alternative out there. And I think it makes sense that our alternative to Trump is freedom. I think we can sell that idea. And I think the left can help in selling that idea, because in the end, this is the heritage of the left. You know, the left began in a kind of liberal conviction. I desperately want the left to recapture that. If the libertarians can help and work with the left to bring about this a new principled champion of human rights, free speech, freedom of movement, I'm all for it. I think it's extremely urgent priority, because otherwise we're going to be faced with something that none of us want to face again.
Yes. And I wanted to tell one real quick anecdote. Right after the Trump election, some of my friends on the left, who I think may have been overreacting very quickly to the election, were like, what do we do? What do we do? And I knew people who were self-defining as LGBT, and they were freaking out about the election of Trump and the way these alt-right people were acting. And I said to them, libertarians will actually defend you on these civil rights issues, especially to the LGBT people. I know you said you disagree with the identitarian stuff, and I get that.
Yeah.
But you've also, you're fine with people being who they want to be, too. And libertarians are good at defending people on that.
Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, there's a fine line here. It's you know, I don't even have a problem with a person identifying with a certain, collective, you know, like, well, I'm this, that's fine. It becomes a problem when it becomes an invasive ideology that blinds us to the larger issues of the common good and human rights and that sort of thing. What's more, I actually, you know, I've variously defended kind of a soft identitarianism on the left, mainly because the identitarianism on the right that persisted, you know, from the mid-19th century, early 19th century, really, all the way up until very recently, is very powerful. I mean, we live in a country that not only enslaved people because of race, but then, you know, after the end of slavery, it wasn't really the end of slavery. You know, there was Jim Crow. There was the United States had a eugenics program designed to wipe out non-whites, and then immigration restrictions that basically created the conditions that led to the Holocaust. So there's a very grim and terrible history. My concern about identitarianism is that it keeps being reactionary. It's like, oh, you were bad to us, now we're going to be bad to you. I'd rather look forward in life and stop the idea of our politics rooted in it, or I'm going to punish you because of what, you know, who you are. We need to get away from that. I think to some extent the left contributed to this white nationalist reaction, not just in the U.S., but in Europe also. And nothing is more morally urgent in the world today than a full embrace of traditional liberalism, of whatever variety, whether it's anarchist or, you know, left centrism or even conservative constitutionalism. I don't care what you call it, but we all have liberal roots. Liberalism built the modern world. It saved the modern world. We abandoned it various in the 20th century, and it was very grim. The results were terrible. The 21st century, I want to see a really robust universalist globalism, an embrace, consistent embrace of freedom across the board, and all of us should work together. If you believe that, we should just work together.
Well, a politics of resentment helps no one. I think we can agree on that.
Yeah. I agree with
and,
that.
And I want to thank you again for coming on, Jeffrey Tucker. Is there anything you want to let's leave our listeners on an optimistic note. What do you see for the future? And then just get a final word in here.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I guess to a great extent, I consider myself a student of Murray. He had a gigantic influence, not just on my thinking, but also the way I see the world. And Murray was a wild optimist. I mean, if I were going to sum up his outlook for the future, it's something like human beings are not meant to be caged. We all want to be free. We think about freedom. We behave as if we're free. In our lives, we make choices as if we're free. And the state is the great interloper. And he believed that eventually this artificial period of bondage that we find ourselves in is going to lead to a great age of emancipation. And I believe that, and I see that around me every single day. So I hope to see that great emancipation take place in my lifetime, and I share Murray's optimism about that. I work for the American Institute for Economic Research, which was founded in 1933. I'm the editorial director, and I feel like I'm building something really beautiful there. So if you want to check out that webpage, feel free to do so, and follow me on social, of course.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show, Jeffrey Tucker.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and let me also thank you for your very prescient and intelligent questions. Many of these subjects I've never had a chance to talk about before, so I'm grateful to you for that. Thank you again.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Jeffrey A. Tucker on Murray Rothbard and the libertarian critique of the alt-right. As I said in the introduction to the interview, I leave it to you, the listener, to make your own judgment about Murray Rothbard, libertarianism, and the possibility of tactical, limited alliances between libertarians and other political ideologies and movements. I think our dialogue provides some food for thought. But you let me know what you think. Gonna close out the show with a track by the Witch House band Will's Fly entitled Free Again.